Hello, everyone, and welcome to Managed Healthcare Executives Monthly Tuning into the C-Suite podcast. In this podcast series, editors of MHE chat with healthcare professionals and executives in the C-Suite. Our conversations are about the most important issues facing American healthcare today, such as its cost, effectiveness, delivery and organization, and its fairness. Listen in, learn a lot. Featured in this latest episode of Tuning into the C-Suite podcast is Paul Frunston, Director of Health Benefits Research at EBRI. Frunston sheds light on the evolving landscape of health benefits in this episode with editors of Managed Healthcare Executive. He also shared the challenges employers face in designing health plans that steer employees toward high-value care. In addition, he shared insights on high-deductible health plans, noting that while they initially led to reduced healthcare usage, they don't deliver significant long-term savings. Looking ahead, Frunston emphasized the potential of technologies such as AI and mobile apps to empower employees to better understand their health benefits and make more informed decisions during open enrollment. Well, for the first question, what trends do you see in incentives and health plan benefit design? So, for example, there was a lot of hope that insights from behavioral economics would steer people to make high-value choices. So I guess, has anything from those efforts really stuck? And maybe, if so, like, what's worked?
Yeah, I think employers, they're in a difficult position when it comes to designing their health plan using incentives. It's really challenging to have different types of, let's say, cost sharing for different types of healthcare services. I think ideally they would like to do that, figure out a way to incentivize the high-valued services, de-incentivize low-valued services. And to some degree, we've seen a little bit of that, especially with the incentivizing high-valued services. I think perhaps one of the best examples lately has been related to HSA plans. One of the criticisms when the HSA law was passed 20 years ago was that preventive services could be covered outside of the deductible, things like cancer screenings. But it was a very narrow definition on what could be excluded from the deductibles. And after years of kicking and screaming, the IRS in the summer of 2019 came out and said, look, we're going to allow these 14 services to be covered outside deductibles, things like insulin for people with diabetes. And we saw a pretty strong response from employers very quickly to move, you know, at least one of those 14 services. Not every employer did all 14 services, but you know, within 2 years of the IRS releasing that notice, three quarters of employers had at least added one of those 14 services, or at least allowed coverage outside deductibles for at least one of those 14 services. The interesting thing to me is that years ago, we tried to do a study looking at what's the best cost sharing above deductibles to manage use of healthcare services. Is it coinsurance or is it co-pays? And we found next to nobody with co-payments above deductibles. So we couldn't even do the study. It was something like maybe 1% of our sample. So it wasn't worth doing. But the interesting thing is a lot of the employers that added or took these 14 services out of deductibles added co-payments for those services instead of co-insurance, which is, to me, that's very interesting because you've got co-payments, a deductible, co-insurance, you know, three different types of cost sharing within a health plan. I think employers would like to figure out a way to incentivize the use of high-valued providers. Steer people to, certain hospitals or certain doctors or certain types of outpatient services. I don't think they've got it quite right yet. I've seen examples where they've done that based upon more so on cost and quality. But this is something employers would like to do. And And I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see more and more of it, just as the data develops and the technology develops to analyze that data. And to the problem is you're potentially creating a very, I like to call it a sophisticated plan design, but it, for the average user, it's a very complicated plan design.
It sounds like it. I mean, especially you said over 20 years ago, this was kind of a developing thing. So it's still growing and evolving in a lot of ways. And you guys are seeing from research what's working, what's not working. Yeah, very interesting. Now for my next question, so kind of where we were talking about deductibles. So there's some evidence and a strong narrative that high deductible accounts are problematic, and people are avoiding care altogether, or don't necessarily select wisely. So where are we with high deductible tax preferred accounts or HSAs, as we previously discussed?
So I think you need to separate out. You could look at deductibles and then you could look at the accounts, because there are a lot of people in plans with high deductibles that don't have an account, right? And you could argue that it's the deductible that changes the way people use healthcare services, perhaps more so or at least differently than the account does when it's attached to the deductible, right? We know what deductibles do when people move from low deductible plans to high deductible plans. Use of healthcare services do fall. It does look like it's a one-time hit, right? Because the high users of healthcare, we typically quote the 80-20 rule, right? The 20% of the population that use 80% of the healthcare, they're going to hit their deductible every year, right? And an even smaller percentage, 10%, account for 70%, almost as much healthcare. They're going to hit their deductible every year. And chances are, maybe the first year they're going to change the way they use healthcare, but they're going to figure out they're going to hit their deductible regardless. So it really becomes the price that they face at the end of the year is going to drive their behavior at the beginning of the year more so than the deductible. Right. So, and that's why oftentimes you see as employers move to high deductibles, it's only a one-time savings. And you got to figure out how to manage the people that use the most healthcare. The account is interesting because the question is, does the account create a savings mentality or a spending mentality? Right? Especially if your employer is putting money in your HSA, right? Do you view that as sort of first dollar coverage? And a lot of employers put money in people's HSA for that purpose, so that, to minimize the effect of the deductible. And we have found, this is a study from almost 5 years ago, so I'm trying to remember exactly what we found. That I think once you reach a certain account balance, it may start to change your behavior. People with larger balances start to use more healthcare services. And that certainly makes sense, right? Because if you think about it, once you have enough money in your account to cover your deductible, then essentially you might view that as first dollar coverage. And very few people max out their contributions. So they're not really using it as a savings vehicle, or at least most people aren't able to use it as a savings vehicle in the sense that they're putting in as much money as allowed to. And most people aren't investing the money, right? So most people view these accounts more as a spending account to cover, today's healthcare services rather than a savings account. Even though, going back to that 80-20 rule, 80% of the population should really be thinking about these accounts as savings accounts, because in any given year, they're not going to use a whole lot of healthcare. And I guess one more thing to keep in mind is we just released a study on related to this IRS notice and medication adherence, right? We wanted to see what happens. Like I said, we know what happens when deductibles go up, people use less healthcare services. So we wanted to put the opposite to the test. When you take certain medications out of deductibles, does the use of those medications go up? And we did see an increase. It wasn't a large increase, but the interesting thing is when we looked at this like 10 years ago, when we were looking at a population that moved from a low deductible plan to a high deductible plan, use of certain medications fell, but it didn't fall that much, right? So we wouldn't expect the increase today to be that high, because it wasn't that, much higher to go. It's not like we're seeing, You know, we're not seeing a reduction from, like, you know, 90% of the population with diabetes being medically, you know, adherent to their medications down to, you know, 20%. You know, it's more like, you know, I think it was about a 10 percentage point drop. So probably went from, I'm making this up, from about 90 to 80. And now maybe it's come back a little bit from that.
Okay, thank you. And you mentioned the IRS, IRS notice. To my knowledge, I'm not sure if this is my next question I was going to ask. I'm not sure if it relates to the same thing. So does the IRS notice the 2019-45 that allows HSA eligible health plans to cover the 14 classes, drug classes? Does it address the problems of the HSA?
Yeah, so the IRS notice specifically said these 14 services can be excluded from deductibles in HSA plans. Outside of HSA plans, you could do whatever you want, right? So if an employer offered only a high deductible plan that wasn't HSA eligible, they could take anything out of that deductible that they chose to before the IRS came out with this notice, because the notice only affects HSA eligible health plans. And in those 14 services, seven of them were related to medications, and seven of them were related to just healthcare services more generally.
Okay, thank you. Now, to turn to the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA, which I think
ERISA.
ERISA, thank you.
ERISA.
Thank
you. That ERISA. One, you only have one choice on how to
Yes, thank you for that, ERISA. So with that, I know you guys came out with a report recently, and it seems like the proportion of employers who are self-insuring is increasing, especially about large employers. So why is that?
Yeah, so ERISA basically provided the framework to allow employers to self-insure their health plans. And what that means for large employers is that they become their own insurance company. Right. They may contract with an insurance company to administer the plan, but it's the employer that's on the hook for any claims. The insurance company is not at risk. The employer is. And we've seen an increase in self-insurance since ERISA passed. Lately, you know, the numbers have been ebbing and flowing. You tend to see that with surveys. It looked like for a couple of years, large employers were pulling back from self-insurance. But again, we weren't seeing this gigantic drop. You know, it was a percentage point here and there every year or so, which made me curious. But the definition of a large employer in this survey was 1,000 or more. And my guess, it was the smaller end of the large employers that might have been changing their plan. Sorry, do you need me to re-record that? Okay, they may have, you know, for some, you know, a couple of years ago, private health insurance exchanges were all the rage. And one of the exchanges that was very popular at the time required employers to go from self-insured to fully insured. That may have had something to do with it. It may be a statistical anomaly. It doesn't look like, you know, again, you know, we're not looking at a large drop in the percentage of large employers that are self-insuring. You know, I think the more interesting thing is what's happening in the small and mid-sized market, where you have seen an increase since the Affordable Care Act passed, and that was expected. The one thing the data we have doesn't capture is the dynamics around these numbers, right? So to what degree are small employers going to a self-insured plan and then dropping it like a year or two later because they had bad experience? Even if they had stop loss coverage, ultimately the bad experience is going to show up in their stop loss premiums. So we're only seeing like the net number. The net number's been going up, but the sort of the noise behind that number is not something we've been able to capture, which is true of the large group market as well.
Okay, thank you. And yeah, whatever was in the background, it sounded like one little jingle, so I could barely hear anything. So you're good.
Okay.
Now, for my next question, this is kind of a very long-winded one, but I'll rephrase back to the beginning again. So is there any way to generalize about whether employees benefit from self-insurance? So obviously self-insurance means that state regulations don't apply. Does that mean, for example, the employees don't get some important services covered, such as the IVF services that have been in the news so much recently. So again, is there any way to generalize about whether employees benefit from self-insurance?
There are some ways you could generalize. When it comes to state mandates, most large employers that are self-insured cover the state mandates, right? And there may be exceptions like IVF, but large employers are pretty generous with the scope of the benefits covered by their plan. I think the way in which employees benefit from ERISA and self-insurance is that, you know, employers that are self-insured, the benefit to the employer is that they're offering the same benefits to everybody, regardless of where they're located in the U.S., right? It makes it much easier than offering 50 different health plans if you're in 50 states. And employees benefit from that because if they relocate with the same employer, they don't have to change anything with their benefits, right? So they don't have to think about a new plan. They don't have to think about a different network. The formula, the drug formulary stays the same, so they don't have to change prescription drugs potentially. I think that's a huge benefit to employees. It's just that predictability of what their benefits are going to look like if they relocate.
Thank you. Now for more easier, lightweighted questions, just to kind of wrap up, is there anything outside of, you know, this discussion that Ebri is working on that you'd like to discuss or you look forward to sharing?
We got a number of projects in progress or things we're thinking about doing. And of course, I don't want to make any promises as to what's going to come out when, because if I do, people are going to start asking me for papers that are just sort of concepts at this point. We've got some work going on related to gene therapies. We've got some work going on related to high-cost claimants. Our consumer engagement and healthcare survey just kicked off for this year, but we're not going to feel that for a few months, and the results won't be out till probably late January, early February. We might do some work on GLP-1s, and we're doing some work on the availability of coverage, which is something we do around this time every year. So a bunch of things in progress that we're juggling. Maybe you'll see another telemedicine study come out soon.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be great to see. Thank you for that.
And the one thing I can tell you we're working on is related to ERISA.
Okay.
Right. So we did a series of focus groups or focus group-like meetings with employers earlier this year to get their input on what's valuable to them when it comes to ERISA and ERISA preemption. And I think the plans are to release that on September 12th. So that one, I can be specific on the date.
Okay.
It could move by a week or two, but it's not going to move by a month or two.
Okay.
So be on the lookout for that.
Well, yeah. So just my last question, just if there's anything I didn't touch on as far as your insights, maybe to the future of employment-based health benefits or any innovations in health plan design, you know, please share.
I think the innovations aren't necessarily going to be, you know, to some degree, they'll be in health plan design, but more so the tools that employers can give employees to help them navigate their health plan and healthcare services. Like, I think we're just on the cutting edge of that when it comes to, you know, use of AI, taking advantage of, you know, mobile phones and what that means for putting information into people's hands. I've seen some pretty cool examples, especially related to drug benefits. And I think that's where things have started, because drug benefits are, you know, claims are adjudicated at the point of service, right? You know, you go to the pharmacy, you know exactly how much your share is, and you know, you can't walk away from the pharmacy without paying your share. And you could do some really cool things in terms of telling people, here's how much this prescription will cost at, let's say, different pharmacies. And if your location services are turned on your phone, it'll show you on a map how far you are from each of those pharmacies and how the price might vary to you. It's harder to get there with outpatient services and certainly inpatient services, because those claims aren't adjudicated in real time, but they're starting to be, right? I'm seeing more and more examples where that is possible. So I think, you know, the sky's the limit when it comes to using, you know, providing people, developing these technologies to provide to your workers and their families to help them navigate, you know, their health care. And certainly the same thing with health insurance, just the information, the way you could present it to people to help them make better choices when it comes time, you know, when you know, like now we're on the verge of open enrollment.
Yeah. There's a lot of opportunities there, especially as AI and, you know, telehealth and all that just keeps evolving and evolving and evolving. Well, yeah, that's all I had for you, Paul.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. It was great chatting with you and
same here.
Yeah. And learning more about, you know, just benefit design, self-employment, or self-insurance overall. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for tuning into this month's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, and follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit us at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.